Good evening and welcome. It's KBC Arts, arts and entertainment in our region as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Coming up December 10th in Upland, the legends of R&B and doo-wop live in concert, including Eddie Holman, Harold Winley's Clovers, Mary Wilson of the Supremes, and tonight's guest, Caesar Berry of the Original Times. That's coming up later in the program. First, though, you may know about the tiny home movement, whether it's creating a getaway dwelling, a simpler way to live, or trying to help with homeless populations. Emmanuel Rogers has more.
Joining us today is author Derek Deke Diedrickson to talk about his new book, Micro Shelters. Thank you for joining us today, Deke.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Deke, my first question is, why the book Micro Shelters?
How much time we got? It's a culmination of my obsession and love with just small structures, and it runs the gamut. I mean, the aim was to be eclectic and to showcase stuff I've done over the years, but that of my friends, too. So it's 59 different designs, but it runs from tiny houses with full-out bathrooms and kitchens all the way to more seasonal cabins, tree houses, even kids' forts and backyard offices and treehouse offices, all that stuff in between. So it's a very eclectic book with a ton of color photos. And I mean, we'll get into it a little more later, but
oh, yeah.
I've been into this so long, it was kind of something I just wanted to and had to do to get these crazy designs out there.
Man, and there are some wonderful designs in this book, Micro Shelters.
Oh,
there really are.
You.
Oh, you're welcome. I was having so much fun. I was actually looking at a lot of things on your site, relaxshacks.com, before I came, and I almost got lost in what I was doing instead of what I should be doing.
Yeah, there's something like, I have like 1,400 posts on there. I mean, I don't blog as much as I used to because I'm so busy building and doing workshops all the time and traveling, but there's a lot of content on there.
Okay, now I would like to ask also, for those that you've worked with and for the people that have watched you on DIY and so many other shows, you know, including PBS shows, and you've done so much, what are some of the appeals of these structures to the public?
I think everybody has in them some yearning for simpler times when you were a kid building forts, cozy little nook spaces. You look at kids and even people, like adults, they gravitate towards these little cozy spots. You know, you want to get comfortable, you don't go sit in the middle of your living room on the wooden floor. You go into a little love seat in this little space, and I think there's something in the DNA of people, almost like wolves with packing and dogs, like that. It's a control over one's environment. It's a safe, cozy space to go to. So that's one level of it. But with smaller spaces in the tiny house movement, you know, it's become huge through the immediacy of the internet. And I think there's a couple reasons for that, why people are pushing or desiring to scale things back.
Right.
I think we're dealing with a very aware culture these days, a lot of intelligent, well-read people who are on top of current issues, from things dealing with knowing what's in one's food to living environmentally. There's the environmental aspect of being attracted to living in a smaller space, a tiny house or tiny cabins, less to build, less site invasive, less to clean, less to maintain, less to furnish, less to heat. So by that, it saves you money, is also environmentally friendly. And I think we're also seeing a lot of people in this technologically advanced age who are very much so into getting back to the roots, to working with their hands, to using tools, and that's absent from a lot of people's lives and jobs these days. And what could trump building one's own home with your bare hands?
You brought up the fact that people today are thinking about different things in their environment and in their lives. And one of the things that our parents, you know, they grew up and they thought about retiring, maybe traveling across country in their motorhome, things like that. These things are just as packed full of amenities as many of the high-end motorhomes that I've seen in my life. But I wanted to ask you, what are some of the other benefits that people have in the use of these structures?
There's a lot of benefits, and I mentioned some before, but uses, you're finding them used from like full-time living to guest houses in one's backyard.
Wow.
To offices, to rental units. You know, Airbnb.com is huge now. You know, tiny houses are so trendy, you're seeing them like in every city. There's, I guarantee you, some kind of tiny house or small listing or a tree house. I've stayed in a lot of tree house bed and breakfast. So that's another use there.
Wow.
You know, people are using them as storefronts because you think about it, you're driving by on the street and what's more attractive or eye-grabbing is some cute little gingerbread tiny house on the side of the road that doubles as a coffee shop.
Right.
You know, I've seen some being used as food trucks. There's so many uses. It's incredible.
Now, there's also plans, floor plans, concepts. I mean, so much chalked into this book. What are some of the do's and don'ts of building these structures, and in particular, the stationary types?
A lot of people are building them on wheels these days for the sake of mobility. flexibility or the loophole in terms of zoning or it being allowed in your yard because it's not permanent. I think people oftentimes skip right over the possibility of just building it on skids, like pressure-treated long timbers or runners, which is done with a lot of shed kits. This enables you to get to the actual building and structure of the house a lot quicker. You're not paying as much money for the trailer. And if you don't plan on moving much, you still have the option where you could pull something like that in a big flatbed truck, hiring someone, of course.
Of course.
I think a lot of people also potentially make the mistake of, there's the whole TV romance, the tiny house and wheels, travel anywhere, you know. I hear from these people who almost seem like they want to commute to work every day with towing their house. You better get another job for gas if that's going to be the case, because you're pulling a house with a vehicle, and they're not so aerodynamic. So that would be one of the don'ts. Don't think you could be running for milk every morning with a tiny house behind you. That will get old real quick.
Okay. And California gas prices don't go down so quickly.
Oh, yeah. Every time I go over there, I'm like, oh, my God. This is what the future is going to look like on the East Coast when it hits us. It's like it's shocking. But a lot of people also seem to put too many dormers in the roof sometimes to gain space in their loft. But you're creating a lot of wind drag. You're creating a lot of valleys and places where water will infiltrate over time. Anytime you penetrate that roof with skylights, with dormers, you better do a great flashing job, but still, that's the number one place where down the road, and this is me being a former home inspector, right, that's where you're going to get your leaks. Keep the roof simple. If you're traveling a lot, put your door on the rear of your travel end, not towards the tongue of the trailer, because when you're driving, you're bulldozing wind and rain into your front door and under it into your house. People get carried away with windows where you're kind of weakening the whole structural wall integrity of the house. You want to put this giant, like, coffee shop bay window you found for free in the side. Well, that kind of hurts the whole integrity of your house, which is under a lot of pressure and stress when traveling on the highway and hitting bumps and dirt roads. So, I mean, there's a lot of don'ts. The big do before you get started, just do your homework and make sure you plan accordingly. Exhaust all avenues of information. These days, people are blessed with YouTube. Anytime I have a computer problem, there's some 6-year-old out there who tells me how to fix something on my computer, you know, or my washing machine or my dryer broke a couple months ago. I went on, and sure enough, there's a video tutorial on how to replace the belt and a couple other parts, which I did for about $20. Exhaust all avenues of inspiration and information, and really field out and know what you need in your tiny house before you design it. You don't want to overlook things and, like, I fit all this junk in there, but I have no visual space, so it feels claustrophobic, or no space to move about and enjoy the house. It's all just Legoed together and stacked. Okay. That's bad design.
That's Deke Diedrichsen, author of Micro Shelters, RelaxShacks.com for more. Later in the program, we'll hear from Caesar Berry of the Original Times. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online at kvcrnews.org.
Now, you know, most of us today are budget conscious, really budget conscious.
Oh, certainly.
And we don't have pool homes and guest homes. You know, you have some really great photos in this book and on your site. You have micro shelters, as you said, on wheels, in trees, for young and old alike. What makes them so practical?
My aim with all these, and like the tiny house landscape and the shelter and cabin and vacation cabin landscape has changed a bit, where a lot of people are looking for the big profit margin and kind of going overboard, where you're seeing these super fancy tiny homes, and those are great, and they are fitting for certain people, and I get it. But I've always been a fan because I grew up, I didn't have a lot of money. My father, he was a school teacher, taught woodworking, and in the summer, to make ends meet, my mother sold Avon, and then my father built decks with another teacher, and I was always around that environment. But it was all about fixing things on your own and living cheaply. But the budget-friendly aspect plays into it, certainly. But what I aim to do is keep it simple. Mm-hmm. I think by getting really fancy with some of these tiny houses and designs, you're alienating a certain group of people. Like, I have a plan set in RelaxShacks.com, which is to build a vacation cabin for $1,200. That's like start to finish.
Wow.
That's something pretty much almost everyone could afford if you saved up and had a place for it. It's not a $12,000 or $120,000 cabin. It's simple, but it's a transforming A-frame cabin for $1,200. That's always been my goal, to make things simple, accessible, and in some cases, to bridge out these options to the homeless population.
Right.
You know, how can you build things cheaply, make them appealing looking, and be functional at the same time? I'm a big fan of a lot of 1970s designs that really showcase those ideas. Lester Walker, this guy Jeff Milstein, who developed the Bolt Together House, which is my favorite tiny house or cabin design ever that few know of. I'm a big fan of all that throwback stuff where the idea was build cheaply, keep it simple, but you still can make it look pretty fantastic.
Yeah, and I've seen a lot of them do really look great.
I mean, some of the cabins and micro shelters I built for like $200, $300.
Wow.
Because it all comes with recycled material. It's how I save a lot of money. and infuse a ton of character into it. You get these old vintage boards from a barn that have a certain patina or crown molding from somewhere or whatever else. Forces you to be creative and makes the whole process fun. How can I work this into this structure? And it gives it that unique, one-of-a-kind look so that my structures or whoever I'm building for, it doesn't look like it's straight off the shelf of Lowe's, Home Depot, or wherever else. I go to those stores all the time. I'm not knocking them.
Right.
But take the stuff from the chain stores and infuse some other rare character into it with materials you're not going to find produced anymore.
Now, I remember as a child, my fort was basically blankets over chairs.
Been there. And I got kids, so we still do that now.
Now, you mentioned also the homeless, and that was a really big question I wanted to ask you. Are these shelters being used for homeless? How can states and city governments actually do better in using these things that we can actually help alleviate the homeless problem?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. But a lot of my early videos were structures based as prototypes for the homeless. I was trying to spread the idea, like, in your city, if you want to build stuff on the cheap that would even temporarily sleep someone and keep them safe, you know, out of the elements, here's
right.
something you could build that I did that was like $100, $200, $300. You're seeing a lot more prototypes being developed for the homeless, but
right.
never spread at a mass scale because, unfortunately, there's still this mindset that I'm all for it, but not in my backyard.
Okay.
You know, there's a lot of people, I don't want to attract any more homeless people to my neighborhood when they find out we offer them these great little funky, neat-looking tiny houses on wheels. You are starting to see, I think, near Portland or somewhere, there was like a little tiny house homeless village. There's a couple being developed.
Wow.
And then a lot of videos that have gone viral on people individually building little structures on wheels for homeless people in their neighborhoods. Later, with some of these, unfortunately, you get, with codes and liability, you get opposition from the town government, from the city government. So it's always this very tough battle. People want to do good, but they're not sure how to, and they don't want to wade through all the red tape in some
right.
cases to get to that goal, which it's too bad.
It really is. Now, this question, and just it came to me as you were talking about this. I was watching the news as Los Angeles talked about spending $100 million starting in October for the homeless problem, but they really didn't explain what they're doing. Do city governments contact you or people like you to get input on how these things can be utilized?
I won't mention names. There's a couple organizations out there that have built shelters for the homeless and receive funding for them, and I've tried to work with them and said, listen, I'll even design something, because I thought their designs just weren't good-looking, weren't standable. You know, and that's pretty important. You want a place to stay. You want to be able to stand up, at least,
yes.
You know, if you're going to be there for a long period of time. But I was kind of met with opposition, as tactful as I tried to be, because they were all kowtowing to big sponsors to take it to the next level and were overly cautious at what approaches, materials, and whatever else they used in things. Like, we can build something, but it has to use these following products. It has to all be new stuff, so universally they can be built, if that makes any sense. We can't use salvage materials. We can't use this and that because we won't get funding from some of the big stores, which to me seems ridiculous. I think the first thing to do is to use salvage materials that might be free
right.
to build something even cheaper and maybe better looking for the homeless. There's a lot of red tape and just outside forces involved, and it's a dizzying array of obstacles, it seems.
I can hear some of the frustration coming through for you, and I know it comes through for a lot of our listeners here today, too.
Yeah, and it's too bad. I mean, I don't know what L.A. is planning, but some cities, you find out we're allocating all this money to the homeless. What that is we're giving them bus tickets to ship them to some other city. That stuff happens. Like, that's not a solution. That's just getting them out of your town.
That's Deke Diedrichsen, author of Micro Shelters, RelaxShacks.com for more. Just ahead, we'll hear about some workshops on micro shelter building. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Online at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Coming to Upland December 10th, it's Legends of R&B and Doo-Wop, live in concert, including Eddie Holman, Harold Winley's Clovers, Mary Wilson of the Supremes, and tonight's guest, Caesar Berry of the Original Times. That's coming up in just a bit. First, though, back to Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Deke Diedrichsen, author of Micro Shelters.
You run micro shelter workshops around the country. How can our listeners find out where these are being held and how to contact you for questions they may have?
Yeah, I mean, it's relaxshacks.com. I have a couple of Facebook pages, too. One of them is just Derek Diedrichsen, my personal page, and a couple others, boards I run. We just did a workshop. I got back 2 days ago from the woods of Vermont. I own a big piece of land up there where we have 9 different cabins, tree houses, all this crazy stuff. So that's our tiny house summer camp we have once a year. Next year will be our 4th year. We'll have one again. But I have a workshop. We've done them, we can say now, from Fargo to Sydney, Australia, my brother Dustin and I, everywhere in between. these workshops are so much fun, and we have so many guest speakers and demos. It's absolute overkill, the amount of information that comes your way while you're physically building the whole three-day weekend. We've had people who have attended our workshop three or four times over and over because they have so much fun, which is so flattering. In this past workshop in Vermont, we had people from Venezuela, Mexico,
wow.
Scotland, three people from Texas. I mean, all over the California. They all came out to the middle of nowhere, Vermont, off-grid to hang out.
Well, now you mentioned the three people from Texas, and I have to ask, because everything's bigger in Texas, are they really building micro shelters?
They are. People are into it. It's funny, the one guy who came up from Texas, he drove from Texas to Vermont, too, was 6'8", so literally bigger in Texas. And this guy was, and I'm a big dude myself, I'm 6'4",
right.
And people think that's funny that I'm into the tiny houses. This guy was huge, and he's looking to build this tiny house. Texas people, you know, pigeonhole all the time as just being very conservative and such, but there's a lot of progressive people out there as well. Tiny houses are bigger than you think down there.
They're everywhere. When you look at things around the world, and we looked at things in South Africa for so long with apartheid,
yep.
And we looked at all those structures that people were living in, those were micro shelters.
Yeah, or you look at the Mexico City shanties.
Yeah.
Those are fascinating. That is some ingenuity there, too, through necessity. You look at some of those places, it's just mind-blowing, like how creative they've got with discarded materials to build these very habitable dwellings.
Yeah, it is amazing. Now, Deke, can anyone with basic knowledge build one of these as a useful structure following your advice here?
Yeah, most definitely. You know, people come to my workshop, they've never really swung hammers before. But we also have people who are like master craftsmen, craftswoman come in too, all looking for a creative boost. I've had many people after these workshops go on and taking their time, doing the research, and, you know, seeking advice and expertise where needed, or hiring an electrician. That's the one thing, hire somebody for that. Don't mess with that yourself. I've had many people go on to build some extraordinary houses, and it's great to see. They'll email me years later, I finally finished my house after taking your workshop, thank you so much. And the house is like, oh my God, it's beautiful. So it's doable. You know, it's one of those things that sounds daunting at first. Don't look at the project as a whole. Take it step by step.
Now, what types of recycled materials do you use or suggest for building micro shelters?
It depends. Like if it's just going to be a clubhouse build or things like that, I can get away with hokier windows and stuff like that. You want to stay away from single pane windows. Their insulative value is terrible. Some of them, the putty work has a asbestos percentage in them. You get lead paint. So try to stay away from that stuff.
Okay.
I find replacement windows all the time on the side of the road. That will help with the build. Doors. The old doors, man, they have a lot more character than the machine stamp ones off the assembly line these days. Lumber. You know, just look around. I have these piles of lumber I was called upon a ways back by this guy, half new, to dismantle his deck. I got paid by the hour, like $20 an hour to do it. And he thought he was making out like a bandit because I took all the wood away from him. I have used that pressure-treated bullnose decking in so many projects, including this past weekend. And not only did I get it for free, he paid me, really, to take it. And it's the power of sometimes with other stuff I found just asking. There was a couple towns over, this guy who had this fence line of 8-foot Douglas fir boards that was like 2,000 feet long, most of it blown down. I noticed one day he was starting to accumulate it for this pagan-looking Wicker Man-esque bonfire. So I left a note in his mailbox. I'm like, if you're going to burn that stuff, I'll take some of it away from you and just save you the hassle. What's the worst that can happen? Just ask. And people love to see that you're recycling stuff. They'll not only give you the stuff, but sometimes take it into their garage and, oh, by the way, I have these windows or this old stained glass. That stuff's gold.
That's Deke Diedrichsen, author of Micro Shelters, RelaxShacks.com for more. Later in the program, we'll hear from Caesar Berry of the Original Times. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online at kvcrnews.org.
Now, I have to ask for those who are thinking, wow, I'm going to save so much money. Do you recommend using recycled things as nails and screws?
Yeah, I mean, screws, you know, sometimes when they're pulled, they're getting bent. They don't re-drive as well. Nails, yeah. I mean, I do in a pinch, I'll like even bent ones, I'll straighten them out because I do a lot of off-grid building. So if it's a choice between reusing a few nails or driving out to a Home Depot or Lowe's that's an hour away from wherever I am in Vermont, I'm going to use the recycled nails. But it's just when you plan and ramp up to your build, it's kind of being aware and pre-planning material-wise. Like if you're at a yard sale and someone's selling a huge bucket of galvanized nails for $2.
Okay.
Yeah, you got to store those, but those, you know, a 5-pound bucket of galvanized nails is running like $100 or more. Grab that, store it. Start planning and finding your unique materials. But being mindful not to become a total and complete hoarder in the process.
What about for novices? Should they even consider using recycled nails or things, or should they just go and go buy some?
I mean, nails. materials, it's going to be easier if you just buy them. It's not like they're really, really, really expensive. The stuff I choose to recycle is like crown molding when I can find it, old barn wood as long as it's not like painted with lead paint, things like that. We did a build for HGTV where we did the entire wall of one of these tiny houses with pallet wood, the non-fungicide sprayed stuff for the record.
Okay.
And we watered down paint and stained each board a slightly different color, and the effect was this like wild calico-looking wall that cost like nothing to make. And we were restricted by a budget, so that was a home run on TV, on camera, it looked fabulous. You used to be able to go in and find like a house that someone's tearing down and let you just go in and pull anything. Now you got to get like an insurance bond and, you know, be covered in case you fell through the roof and got killed. And I understand, but the game has changed. I got some friends who are urban pickers who go into like collapsing factories and pull out old light fixtures and stuff. There's some dubious morals there, I think. But on the other hand, they feel like this building is falling apart. No one's ever going to take this and do anything with it. I'm rescuing it. That's more for decor, you know, light old barn style light hoods. Stuff like that. There's a huge market for those things. Salvage is big right now.
Right. I was looking on relaxshacks.com, and one of the photos that really caught my eye was the tiny house Chattanooga.
That's fantastic. That one.
It was awe-inspiring to me. How do you build a two-story micro shelter and make it with all the amenities of home and have it where it's really practical, you can get around, and it's comfortable?
Yeah, that's one of the fancier tiny houses I've seen, but just so well done. And I'll plug the guy again. His name's Mike Bedsole, B-E-D-S-O-L-E, tinyhousechattanooga.com.
Okay.
Tennessee is actually a hotbed for tiny houses, kind of. There's Tennessee Tiny Homes, Joe Everson, too, a friend of mine. But that one house that was the Colorado Tiny House Jamboree, which was 40,000 people showed up to that, just to show you how big the movement's getting.
Wow.
That house had a Japanese soaking tub. It had two lofts. It had office space. It was off-grid, so it was solar, like ready to go. It had a skylight in the bedroom so you could climb up into the roof or lay there at night and stargaze. It had so many clever and well-thought-out functions and aspects. I was blown away. And we did a video tour of that, which is on relaxshacks.com, spelled out D-O-T-C-O-O-M. My YouTube channel, and that thing in like 2 weeks has got like 170,000 views, so it's doing pretty well.
Yeah, I would actually pay for something like that, put it on a 3-acre lot and just have it sitting in the middle.
Yeah, that one might be for sale still. I'm not sure. I actually talked to Mike just the other day, and I might even be talking to him tonight. I just met him recently, but he's a fantastic, hard-working dude, and that house was impressive.
Yes, it was. Our time is growing short, but I need to ask you, what surprises you most about these structures and the responses that people have to them?
The responses vary. You know, there's the, what the heck is that thing? Or the cliche, like, it looks like an out. What is that, an outhouse? you know, it's like, oh, my God, you know. And then there's also people watch the videos, and if it doesn't have a bathroom, they automatically express their distaste on YouTube. And it's like, listen, don't cheat yourself. Look past that. Watch the rest of the video. You might gain some ideas. But they shut down, you know, put on the horse blinders and shut down their mind before they get to the rest of it. I think what surprised me, I don't know about responses, but the wide variety of people you find who are into this who you might think aren't. At the workshops, I get some, like, big-wig business professionals. I did a workshop in New York City. This guy, and I was joking about being a nerd growing up with comic books. Dude comes up to me, Dennis something. He's the chief editor of DC Comics, and he's, like, looking into tiny houses. I mean, this dude's a high roller, big wig. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. And we also find quite a few people in their advanced years. One guy came to a workshop who you never would think, just look at him, would be in a tiny house. Not only that, he was 80 years old and looking to build a tiny house. And I said, you, sir, are as bad arse as they come. To be that age and, you know, want to build a tiny house, I mean, that's killer.
That's great.
To me is kind of surprising in the scene, just seeing how widespread and eclectic the groups are who are attracted to it.
That is great. Deke, I'm sorry, our time is up, and I am really sad about that because this is a wonderful conversation. I've enjoyed so much.
I enjoyed this. Thank you so much.
You are more than welcome. Micro Shelters has wonderful pictures and advice on building. Thanks for sharing all the great information that you've given us today, and hopefully some of our listeners will be contacting you looking for some help there.
Great. Hey, thank you. I appreciate all of it.
You're more than welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Take care.
Mm-hmm. You too.
Deke Diedrichsen in conversation with Emmanuel Rogers. Deke's book, Micro Shelters, information on workshops, and much, much more at relaxshacks.com. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. We are online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Coming to Upland December 10th, it's Legends of R&B and Doo-Wop live in concert, including Eddie Holman, Harold Winley's Clovers, Mary Wilson of the Supremes, and our next guest, Albert Berry of the Original Times. I like the way she walks. although I found out nobody really calls him Albert. Thanks to a movie, more people know him as Caesar. She knocks me off my
feet. Here she comes walking down the street. That was a nickname my father gave me back in the day, Caesar. I was Albert Alexander Berry III, so Caesar.
Okay. Well, that's much quicker. Okay.
Yeah, because I was a great Edward G. Robinson fan, and when Little Caesar came out, you know, my father, you know, he gave me a gun and holster set years ago, and that's what was put on the back of gold, Little Caesar. So it's been there since then, since about 11, 12 years old.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that goes way back.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Well, now, speaking of names, I've skipped the opportunity to ask a few groups how their name came about, so I definitely want to ask about the Times as a name. But you guys were formed as the Latineers. So
why
the Latineers? Where did that name come from then?
Well, back then, all the groups, you know, there was always a Trainier or a Bonier or whatever the case may be back in the day. Mm-hmm. And we decided to call ourselves the Latineers. We went to Cameo Parkway Records. That's when the name came about.
And then,
during the early 50s and stuff, we ran around the city as the Latineers.
How did that name come about?
Well, Norman Burnett, who was the founder of the group, he came up with the name the Latineers.
Okay.
And he's still with me to today. Him and I, the original members, left. George Williams, George Hilliard, and Donald Banks have all passed away.
We lost Mr. Hilliard just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, right. That was a big one. Because we were all like brothers. We just about grew up together. Donald was George's cousin.
Ah.
So Donald Banks and George Hilliard were cousins. And Donald and I, we met when I was about 10 years old. We've been friends until he passed away.
The Times, then, this was truly a group of kids that grew up being friends, not a band coming together and then becoming friends after that. You guys were friends, and then you were a band.
Right, that's right, that's right. Because Norman and George Hilliard, how they came to meet each other, they used to go to a camp called Settlement Farms. They used to do the talent shows up there. When they met, they did talent shows. They formed a group at the camp. And they won all the talent shows, as a matter of fact. That's what happened.
Oh, cool.
And when their tour of the camp was over, they came back and they became friends and still friends, and they wanted to form a group. So they went on and they did a few shows, and then the other guys, they quit. And that's when Norman called Donald. They needed a bass singer. And then that's when they called me.
Okay, okay. And then you ended up with George Williams a few years later.
Right.
I'm wondering then, when you brought in George Williams, was it that you felt that you were missing a sound that a fifth element could bring? Because you were already a quartet with everything in place.
Right. But what had happened, Norman and George Williams, they worked at Trump University Hospital at the time. And George was driving a forklift in the place, you know, around the hospital, you might say. And Norman heard him singing. George used to sing all the time, and Norman asked him, did he want to join the group. Norman called me, said, I think I found a guy that wants to join the group. I said, well, bring him on over, man. Let's see what's happening. And that's when we figured we had a lead singer. Then we said we had a first, second baritone and a bass. But George was a unique, he was one of the best lead singers come out of Philadelphia.
What is it about Philadelphia, man? There are so many groups that came out of that, not just with the doo-wop era, but well beyond that. Let's talk about the doo-wop era. I've actually spoken with some folks who knew some of the other ones that made it big, and they were just really the next group of guys at the next Burn Barrel or down the hallway in the apartment complex.
Well, what had happened, we used to sing on the corners in Philadelphia. That's where everything just about started, because instead of back in them days, you know, like what you might say, they were gang warring today, but back then we used to compete against each corner. Like, we lived in North Philly, we would go to West Philly, South Philly, Germantown. They had a group, our group would always go up there. That's how we came about traveling around the city, you know, getting into different talent contests, you might say.
All right. Certainly saved a few bruises that way, being a singer and not...
Oh, believe me. Believe me. There's some brutal days after a while.
Yeah. You were tenor or second tenor, so who did what for the rest of the lineup? Can you lay it out for me?
Well, I'm still first tenor. Norman Burnett was baritone at the time, but he moved up to second tenor because after everybody passed away, because George Hilliard was the second tenor. And then Donald Banks was the bass, and of course, George Williams was the lead singer.
As we stroll along together,
this is now a few years after George joined the group, we finally got So Much in Love. And this is a song that stays with us today. There are people that still do this. And certainly your biggest, was this the first recorded and released as well?
With that, we were very lucky because George wrote the song. George came into a rehearsal one night and he said, "Hey man, I got a song." I said, "Well, let's hear it." He sang it and I said, you know, at the time it was called As We Stroll Along.
Right.
You know, and when it happened, we were entered the Tip Top Talent Hunt. They had a Tip Top Red. How that worked, we would audition. All the groups in Chile, they auditioned on the radio. And in order to get your group ahead, you would buy a loaf of Tip Top bread and put the name on the label. That's that weird. Just put the name on the label and send it in. And that's how the vote calculated. When it happened, we met a gentleman named Leroy Lovett, who was a musical director for the talent contest. And he said, "Hey, man, you guys sound pretty good." He said, "I'm going to send you to a guy, Cameo Parkway, whose name was Billy Jackson." Billy Jackson used to be a member of the Rebels. He was the head of the A&R department at Cameo Parkway. We went down and we auditioned about 10 songs a cappella. And we left, and when it happened, we had about 2 or 3 weeks of what they almost a month. I said, "Well, let me give him a call to see what's happening." So I called up down there, and Billy answered the phone in the A&R department. And he said, "Hey, man, I'm so glad you called because we lost your phone number, and we want to record you guys right away."
Oh.
I said, "Whoa." You know? I said, "Well, what song do you want to record?" And he said, "That song, what's that song?" As we strolled along, he said, "Well, we're going to make some changes." I said, "Okay." You know, and him and George Strait just put the hook together, and they changed the name of the song to So Much Love.
Oh, my goodness.
And when it happened, we did it with full orchestration, you know, a cha-cha beat, a jazz beat, a ballad, nice ballad. So the head of the company, Bernie Lowe, he said, "Man, these guys' harmony is so good." He said, "Why don't we just take out all the music?"
Hmm.
And all that was in the record was a drummer with the brushes,
right,
a bass player, and myself. I did the finger snaps.
The finger snaps,
on the
yeah.
record.
Okay.
Right. Then there Marlene Davis, who was with the Orlines at the time before she passed. She's the one that did the high tenor, and the girl female singer in the group, she overdubbed the high vocals on the song.
That's Caesar Berry of the original Times. The Times are part of an all-star lineup coming to Upland December 10th. More about the concert, more from Caesar just ahead. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, also at kvcrnews.org. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. Online at kvcrnews.org, I'm David Fleming. Coming to Upland December 10th, it's Legends of R&B and Doo-Wop live in concert, including Eddie Holman, Harold Winley's Clovers, Mary Wilson of the Supremes, and tonight's guest, Caesar Berry of the Original Times. Information about the concert at affordablemusicproductions.com. Stay with us as we hear about the hits of the times, including Somewhere, So Much in Love, and more. Berry was also amongst the first to hear the Supremes' Where Did Our Love Go? When they were still working it out and wondering if it really would go anywhere. With all the different doo-wop groups literally on each corner or each different part of Philly, what did the Times do to try to differentiate yourselves from the other doo-wop groups?
Well, we weren't the best. We weren't the best because there was a lot of groups in Philadelphia that really, you know, really sang well, you know. And we got together, we did the song called Danny Boy. This would be auditioned on the show with.
The old ballad,
Danny Boy?
Danny Boy? Yeah.
Yeah, and when it happened, make a long story short, I used to work at Philadelphia General Hospital. And everybody was waiting. I told him, I said, "We auditioned for this talent show, et cetera, et cetera." And I took my boom box in at lunchtime. At 12 o'clock, the record song was played, Danny Boy. And that was the worst thing I ever heard in my life. I mean, it was really terrible. I got up from the lunch table and snuck out. Right. So about a month later or so, So Much in Love comes out. But I used to work in the kitchen, and when I walked in, everybody was talking, singing the song. And they said, "Hey, did you hear that song by the Times?" And I said, "Who?" And they said, "You know, So Much in Love." And I never told them it was me because I didn't think they would believe it because of how bad that audition sounds.
Nobody knew. I can't believe that. Such a huge song.
Yeah.
Your coworkers never knew.
I walked in, man, and everybody was singing it. And, oh, boy, they were having a ball with it. They walked around the lunchroom singing it. I'm sitting there like, I want to tell them, but they won't believe me.
Might as well tell them you were Frank Sinatra or something like that.
Hey, believe it.
Yeah, oh, my God.
Believe it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Once I had a love, Ruby, baby, she was my own.
Well, that was early 60s, 1963 or so. Now, also in 1963, we got Groovy Baby from Billy Abbott and the Jewels. Now, the Jewels were actually the Times. Is this right?
That's right. Because what had happened when Billy Jackson went to record the Jewels, Billy Abbott and the Jewels, they weren't that quick in catching on. He said that Cameo Parkway at the time, you know, if you were walking down the hall, say, "Hey, man, come on in. Somebody do the finger snap. Somebody want to do the clapping," or so on. So he brought us in, and we did the background vocals. And the high tenor voice in that song,
yeah,
that was the gentleman from the Blue Notes, brother. He was the original Blue Notes that did My Hero, and that was him. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. So we did a lot of background work while we were at Cameo Parkway. DeeDee Sharp, Chubby Checker. And one of the biggest was with Len Barry after he left. Remember this song, 1, 2, 3?
Sure, yeah.
So that's us in the background.
Oh, wow, nice, okay. Wow.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
That deserves another listen. Oh, my gosh.
Somewhere my love waits for me. Somewhere beyond the sky and sea. Somewhere I'll see her, and my heart will know this is the face that I will sew.
There's another great one for you guys, and I have to know here and there who brought what to the table, because this one, Somewhere, not to be confused with the song from West Side Story, but this version.
Right.
Did you guys know that you were singing a vocalized version of Mozart's Sonata 24?
Well, what had happened, Billy Jackson and Roy Scraton, they came up with the song Somewhere. I think that was after Wonderful, Wonderful. Because Billy Jackson, because George Williams was like a really Johnny Mathis fan, you know? And we did Wonderful, Wonderful, we did the 12th and Never, but Somewhere, we did that when that was a hit for us too.
I felt a recognition when I was listening to it, when he starts singing the lyrics. But then it's not until the all-too-brief piano solo that it's suddenly realized this is the Mozart piece. It's not just based on
it. Wow. Yeah, that little interlude in the middle of the song?
Yes.
Yeah, right. But Roy Scraton was a very good piano player. Matter of fact, we still talk to this day. Song So Much in Love, Lee Andrews and the Hearts were big at the time. And before the record was released, Cameo Parkway executives wanted to give it to him. And Lee Andrews, I mean, they offered him almost like $10,000 for the song. And so we said, no, if we can't do it, nobody does. That's what we felt about it.
That's Caesar Berry of the original Times. The Times are part of an all-star lineup coming to Upland December 10th. More about the concert and more from Caesar just ahead. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, also at kvcrnews.org.
Sometimes we walk hand in hand by the sea. And
you mentioned Wonderful, Wonderful. That was the, Johnny Mathis had that in 57 or so. So whose decision, I suppose, was it to cover a Johnny Mathis hit?
Yeah, it was our producer, Billy Jackson.
Okay, it was Manny.
And what made it so funny was the fact that Johnny Mathis, we never met him, but about a year or so ago, a friend of mine that knew Johnny Mathis, I asked him, could he send me an autographed picture? This is after years, you know, seeing him, working with him, but never talking. And so he actually sent me a photo of himself, right? And Then he called me up and he said he wanted, always wanted to meet the guys that did that song because ours went to number 7 and his went to number 10.
The student beats the master. Okay.
Oh, that was phenomenal. And when So Much in Love came out, that was the first song in a while that knocked the Beatles out of first place.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. On the Billboard charts. I can't remember the first. Our record came up, man. It just zoomed to the top of the charts.
Oh, beautiful. Well, another one that you guys made it big with, in this case, Miss Grace, number 1 in the UK, but only to 91 in the US charts.
Yeah.
Was this a distribution issue?
Well, what happened with that, when we were over there, I forgot when it was, we went over there, I think People was out there.
Mm-hmm.
And we went over to England, and RCA Victor, the executives, heard it over there. And we were over there in England for about a year touring. And they asked us, they said, well, what about this song, Miss Grace? And we put it out. So I said, well, what do you do? Call up the record company back in the United States and see what they say about it, because I didn't have the permission to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And we left England, man, and by the time we got back home, we come to find out that it hit the number 1 charts in the UK, all over the UK. Matter of fact, we just left there last July. We were over there. We did like 3 tours in England so far. And we were there, man, and when we came to the airport, and we ran into people from the 70s that still had our autographs that came to the stage doors this time to get autographs again. They had our original signatures and everything. It was really an experience. It was really nice, you know, because the song is like a monster over there, believe me.
Well, speaking of a different sound there, You Little Trustmaker. Now, this was such a different sound, and that brings me to something. You guys really had an evolution of your sound. Were you adapting to the style of music at the time, trying to put out hits, or did you guys just want to get away from doo-wop? This is what you were doing anyway.
Well, that's one reason we really wanted to get away from the doo-wop scene. You Little Trustmaker, how that came about. We went into the studio and we recorded it, we did it. And George sang it too. Now, I'm going to give you a secret. George sang it too pretty, right? So what had happened, our producer, Billy Jackson, went in and laid down the lead track. And we sat and we listened to it. We said, hey, that sounds pretty good. We put George in the background on that song. Hey, so that's really our producer, Billy Jackson, singing, You Little Trustmaker. Because George, he's singing, You Little Trustmaker. You know what I'm saying? But Billy added that pop sound, you might say. But when we do it on stage, it's off really well. Matter of fact, that's our closing number to our show, You Little Trustmaker. We just released a new record. A friend of mine who I really admired, Terry Johnson of the Flamingos, right? We did a remake of Lovers Never Say Goodbye.
Mm.
It's out on CD Baby now, and we did a song called I'm in Love Again, which I wrote, went along with a gentleman named Leroy Shuler. But Norman and I, we do the duet on Lovers Never Say Goodbye. We added strings. I think I did a pretty good production on it. I don't know if you heard it yet, but it's taking off pretty good for us. And before I met Terry Johnson back in the day, I said if I ever wanted to have a group together, I would want to be like the Flamingos. They were the all-time greatest group out there to me.
Nice. And I was not aware of I'm in Love Again and some of that, so I'm definitely going to be looking that up once we hang up here.
It's on CD Baby now. You pull up the times and you put in I'm in Love Again and Lovers Never Say Goodbye.
You mentioned People a little while ago, and this goes to the late 60s again. This was a hit for several artists, and it doesn't seem so much like a cover, though, because if you think about some of the biggies, say Streisand or, well, there's Sinatra again, you guys didn't so much cover it as you did gave it a different arrangement to really make it your own. Was that Billy Jackson again arranging it?
Yeah, Billy produced all of our stuff. I think Jimmy Wizard did the arrangement on that. I always wanted to do some kind of a rock thing, but I didn't want to get into the rock and roll.
Yeah.
But on the other, to make a long story short, on the other side is so much in love with Gary. Roscoe James McClain, it's like a Coasters type tune, and that's me doing that, you know, with that gravel voice. You know, it's almost like Searching.
Oh, nice, nice.
That's the one that I was hoping that they would put out, but I'm glad they didn't, because to this day, I don't think I can still sing in that voice.
Oh, yeah, that would damage, I suppose. Wow, yeah.
Yes, yes. But So Much in Love, we were lucky. That was the first time in the studio and come out with a number one hit. Well, we were young and scared to death and start traveling all over the country, man. There's a certain thing called preparation. Really not that where that song was going to take us, believe me. But you see us on stage now, it's like singing in our living
room. You know, you were talking about just throwing yourself into a different world. I spoke with Mary Wilson just a few days ago, and she was talking about, for example, when they went and performed for the Queen Mother and Prince Charles and all that, they were still living in the same housing projects that they were in. So they were literally in vastly different worlds because of their success.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So, I mean, when we first met them, we did the Regal Theater in Chicago, I think it was the Regal. I mean, they were young girls, man, and they wanted to meet us, etc. So after the week was over, I asked Diana, I said, well, hey, what y'all going to do when you go back to Detroit? Well, we're going to try one more time. I said, well, what's the name of the song? And they start singing it in the dressing room. Baby, baby, where did our love go? And I'm like, oh, my son, give it to me. There they go. And so Mary, when they came to the Uptown Theater, Mary called me up and she said, Caesar, we got a hit record. We did it. I said, yeah, I heard it. So we went up there and, you know, said hello to them because they went to it up at the Uptown with the Motown Review. And we've been friends since then.
Well, this is going to be a nice reunion for you in just a few weeks.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Mary's a good friend.
Something that you mentioned earlier as we were talking about George Hilliard and Donald Banks and some of the folks passing away, as people left the group, I know we spoke of one guy going from baritone to something else. I'm wondering if any positions shifted to other members, or if, say, the bass was gone, you found another bass, you try to replace the sound.
You know, we're down to four guys now, you know, and there aren't too many bass singers out there anymore in groups. I stayed the first tenor. And we got two gentlemen in the group, Jimmy Wells and Russell Gore Jr. He's our lead singer. And what had happened, Jimmy Wells, he was trying to get in the group like 8-10 years. He said, nah, not ready yet, Brad, you know, but he's our choreographer now, actually.
Okay.
And Russell Gore Jr., he sang with a group called Serenity. They were like the ultimate pop group in Philadelphia. They were great. And what happened, we used to do shows and they used to open up for us. And I hated to go on stage after. Them guys were really, really good. And we weren't prepared. But we had a record.
We mentioned You Little Trustmaker. That is always your closer. Mm-hmm. So do you just really kick it off then with So Much in Love?
We come out with Love Train. Mm-hmm. And we go into The Love I Lost. Then we go into You're Gonna Miss My Lovin'. We throw in Lovers Never Say Goodbye. Then we go into our hit Somewhere. Wonderful, wonderful. So Much in Love. You Little Trustmaker.
Beautiful. A lot of love on
it. It's a well-rounded show. Well-rounded show. It's going to be good. We're going to be with Eddie Holman on this show.
Mm-hmm.
He's a good man from Philadelphia. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully speaking with Eddie soon as well. But we look forward to seeing not only the Times, but the Clovers in there with Harold Winley, Mary Wilson, and you just mentioned Eddie,
right,
so.
Right, it should be an interesting show.
All right, well, I'll never get the chance to say this again, so hail Caesar.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the interview.
Thank you.
And I hope it went off well.
Beautifully.
I'll be looking for you, though, to see you there.
Definitely. 3 weeks, I'll be looking for you.
Right on. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Caesar. Safe travels. That's Caesar Berry of the Original Times. The Times, along with Eddie Holman, Harold Winley's Clovers, and Mary Wilson of the Supremes, will be in Upland December 10th with Legends of R&B and Doo-Wop live in concert. Tickets and information at affordablemusicproductions.com.
And that's just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Caesar Berry and to Nathan Gothels with Affordable Music Productions. Thanks also to Emmanuel Rogers with his interview of author Deke Diedrichsen. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Lindsay Boyd, and General Manager Alfredo Cruz. Beyond the music of the times, music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts, behind us now, for example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. You can find past KVC Arts programs at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.